I think, as most of you know, I'm Terry Thornton. I'm curator of education, and it truly is my pleasure to welcome you to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. Tuesday Evenings is an ongoing lecture series, and we've been doing this for 9 weeks, including this week, for the spring season, and next week is our last lecture for the spring 2014 season. So I invite you to come back for Matthew Buckingham, an extremely interesting artist. I have had an art crush on him for some time, so I'm very excited that he's coming. Tonight, we are fortunate to have Kenneth Goldsmith back with us. Some of you may have seen Kenneth on the Colbert Report, or heard him on Studio 360 recently, or some of you may have been at the reading room last night and heard him do a reading out of his book, Seven American Deaths and Disasters, which is available in the bookstore if you're interested. It was fantastic. But I have to say that I'm very proud that we had Kenneth Goldsmith before Stephen Colbert did, because Kenneth was here for Tuesday Evenings in March of 2010 in conjunction with the exhibition Andy Warhol, The Last Decade, being that Kenneth edited the very compelling I'll Be Your Mirror selected Andy Warhol interviews, which incidentally was the basis for an opera, Trans Warhol, that premiered in Geneva in March of 2007. Upon his last visit, I promised the Tuesday evening audience then, and some of you may have been here then, that due to Kenneth's numerous talents and accomplishments, that I would, in fact, try to bring him back to share insights into his own work. So tonight is me making good on that promise. According to Wikipedia, Kenneth Goldsmith is an American poet. He is the founding editor of Ubu Web. This is in addition to the Wikipedia entry, for which he received the Quartz Electronic Music Award in Paris in 2009, teaches poetics and poetic practice at the University of Pennsylvania, and is a senior editor of Penn Sound. He hosted a weekly radio show at WFMU from 1995 until 2010. He has published 10, and now that's 11, so there needs to be an update on the Wikipedia entry. Books of poetry, notably Fidget from 2000, Soliloquy from 2001, and Day from 2003. And then there's Goldsmith's American Trilogy, The Weather, 2005, Traffic from 2007, and Sports, 2008. He is the author of a book of essays, Uncreative Writing, Managing Language in a Digital Age, which was 2011, and which also won him the 2012 Association for the Study of Art's Present Book Prize. As editor, he published, as I mentioned before, I'll Be Your Mirror, the selected Andy Warhol interviews in 2004, and is the co-editor of Against Expression, an Anthology of Conceptual Writing, 2011. In 2013, he was appointed the Museum of Modern Art's first poet laureate. He resides in New York with his wife, artist Cheryl Dunnigan, and his two sons, one of which is with us tonight. The entry, of course, goes on to lay out many more endeavors and noted accomplishments, such as Kenneth having been invited to the White House on May 2011 to read at President Obama's A Celebration of American Poetry, where he also held a poetry workshop with the First Lady. Now, I read directly from Wikipedia because it is an appropriate way to introduce Kenneth Goldsmith, to read from Wikipedia. And as I understand it, the entry was written by Kenneth's students at the University of Pennsylvania. Teaching is very important, is a very important part of Kenneth's career. He also held the Ann Schultz Distinguished Fellow Professorship in American Studies at Princeton University from 2009 to 2010. Publishers Weekly called Kenneth's writing some of the most exhaustive and beautiful collage work yet produced in poetry. In an enlightening document on his work, Kenneth Goldsmith, Sucking on Words, which premiered at the British Library, poet Christian Bach referred to Kenneth as our James Joyce for the 21st century. As a poet, writer, editor, professor, and music critic, Kenneth acknowledges few boundaries in his practice. With a BFA in sculpture from RISD, he has written about, continuously participated in, and is recognized by the visual art world, as demonstrated by his inclusion in the 2012 Documenta 13 as part of the 100 Notes, 100 Thoughts book series. It is Kenneth's commitment to what he would call uncreativity as creative practice that first caught my attention and won my heart, ultimately led to him being here for this Tuesday evening's presentation titled My Career in Poetry, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Institution. Please join me in welcoming Kenneth Goldsmith.
Wow. That was an amazing... That was tonight's lecture. You can go home now. Wow. And I'm really not going to talk about much of what we spoke about, of what Terry spoke about tonight here. I'm actually going to reflect on my time at MoMA, but not even so much directly of my time at MoMA as to sort of the things that I learned having been ensconced in this institution for the past year. I just want to stop, and I also want to thank Karen from the Reading Room in Dallas, who also helped make my trip possible. Thank you so much. It was a great honor to read at your gallery last night. And thank you all for coming tonight. I'm so glad to be back in Fort Worth. This is my third time here. The first was at TCU for the Warhol show there, and then, of course, one other time here. There's something about Fort Worth that feels like home, and I can't quite find out what it is, but I always love coming back here. Okay, so my career in poetry, or how I stopped worrying and how I learned to stop worrying and love the institution. Now, let me just find... I'm pressing an arrow. Okay. Okay, great. Okay. So we start off with this epigraph from John. Here in the museum, we do not invite trouble, only establishment woes, sort of. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the first thing I would like you to notice tonight is this quiet and inconspicuous door to the Museum of Modern Art in New York City. It is the back door, and most people don't know that such an entrance exists. If you go to MoMA any day, on the 53rd Street entrance, you go into the lobby and you can't move. But on that same day, try the back door. It's completely empty, perhaps with the exception of a few noisy school children. And if you step into this door, and to the right is this small gallery. Now, this gallery, in my opinion, is one of the liveliest galleries in all of the museum. You never know what you're going to run into there. One time I recall the gallery entirely transformed into what looked like a replica of a 19th century rural country store that actually turned out to be a full-scale model of the studio of J. Morgan Pewitt. Her upstate studio and residency was actually moved directly into the into this place. Another time, I encountered this group of people sharing a meal on a rug that they had hand-knit in a communal way. It's always active, filled with people doing things. So for all the lip service paid to relational aesthetics in the art world, it seems like socially related activities are happening in this space every day. After all, this is the wing of public programs, education, and research and libraries. And people really is what they do best. The exhibitions held here often feature books and ephemera culled from the archives of the MoMA Library. In 2010, the MoMA Library mounted the first museum show dedicated to the outsider poet Byrne Porter in that very gallery. Now, Byrne Porter was originally a scientist who worked on the Secret Manhattan Project, whose mission was unknown even to those who were working on it. When revealed to him, he was horrified, and it turned him into a lifelong pacifist and devotee of the arts. And for the rest of his life, he was involved with a major parade of American figures of 20th century art and literature, such as this book that he did for Henry Miller. While living on the West Coast in the 1940s, he published risque works by and about Henry Miller, and this is a poetry anthology that he published in 1945. A decade later found him running a gallery that showed the then unknown Bay Area figurative painters like Richard Diebenkorn, and he finally found himself back at his ancestral home of Belfast, Maine, where he worked as a publisher, poet, performer until his death in 2004, putting out scores of these kind of self-published pamphlets, broadsides, cassettes, and chapbooks. He obsessively made drawings, collages, and numbers of these found poems. These are just things, he was actually the inventor of found poetry. By the time he died, he was a legendary cult figure. You could say he could be compared to somebody like Kenneth Anger, wildly brilliant, wildly influential, and little known to the larger world. Okay? And this guy was so poor toward the end of his life, he lived on going from opening to opening in university art galleries and hoarding up cheese and bread and taking it home with him. Okay? Now, how did Byrne Porter, really, this weird outsider, get into the MoMA library? Through the same door, metaphorically speaking, through the back door. That's another one of Porter's. Now, back in the 1970s, the MoMA librarian was Clive Philpott, this guy, and he devised this brilliant scheme whereby anybody could have their work officially acquired by the Museum of Modern Art if they mailed their stuff to the library. And once word got out, the museum began getting boatloads of ephemera, mail and correspondent art, zines, concrete poetry, cassette tapes, various scribblings, Amazon publications, broadside, all sorts of unofficial culture made its way into the museum's collection. But sometimes the back door was actually used to get works into the museum itself. So, for instance, in 1991, Chuck Close was asked to curate an artist choice exhibition. Now, Close decided to choose a selection of portraits from MoMA's collection, and he wanted to include Ray Johnson, who at the time, unbelievably enough, was still not in the MoMA collection. So to get himself into the collection, Johnson stuffed this funky photocopy cartoon of William de Kooning into an envelope, mailed it off, there's the envelope, mailed it to Clive Philpott, courtesy of the library, and sure enough, it was entered into the collection of MoMA with the credit line, Gift of the Artist, the Museum of Modern Art Library, Special Collections, and therefore he was eligible to be included in a show curated by Chuck Close. I mean, isn't this, it's this whole kind of crazy secret history. So like everyone else, Byrne Porter began sending crates of his stuff into the library. And it sat dormant for 30 years until Rachel Morrison, a MoMA librarian, began sifting through it, and she finally mounted this first large exhibition of Porter. It was a radical, eye-opening, and inspiring show, and sadly, but predictably, very few people saw it. There was no reviews of it. Like every other show mounted in this backspace, it was by and large ignored. Now, not long after the MoMA show, Porter's seminal 1972 book, Found Poems, which I showed you before, was reissued by this small press with a foreword written by none other than David Byrne, the founder of the influential band Talking Heads. Byrne eloquently traces and contextualizes the lineage of Porter's found poems, citing Jerome Rothenberg's collection of Dada and Native American texts from the 1960s and 70s. He talks about, this is of course David Byrne, he talks about the books of Marshall McLuhan and Quentin Fiore. He talks about the lyrics of John Lennon songs, and of course, he talks about Andy Warhol's ephemeral products of the Silver Factory, all as being essential to his to situating Porter's historical works. Byrne talks about how he was inspired to write something after encountering the works of Byrne Porter, telling how in the early 70s, after dropping out of art school, he transcribed a complete broadcast of the game show The Price is Right, commercials and all. And David Byrne says, quote, the idea that holding this stuff up for examination might yield something was just in the air at that time. Somehow leaving it raw and unfiltered seemed the way to go. It simply meant to say, this is here. And Byrne says, I continued making lists and questionnaires around the same time I was beginning to write songs. Obviously, I was ready to receive this stuff. And it's wonderful to think that Byrne Porter, this crazy outsider artist, had a hand in shaping something as huge as the Talking Heads. But this is the secret way that culture flows. Connections are made underground through back doors. Long after these ideas are digested, they enter triumphantly through the front door, applauded by directors, curators, and trustees, but they always begin at the back door. My interactions with MoMA as a poet have always been through the back door. I've done several readings and events there over the years. Of course, I was their poet laureate last year. And these days, poetry at MoMA never happens through the front door. It's always let in through the back door via the Modern Poet series that Laura Bayless, the assistant director of adult programs, had been running there since 2006. In that time, she has invited over 50 poets to read. And it's not just experimental or emerging poets that come through the back door. I recall seeing a reading in that auditorium. In the back, they have a back auditorium where the poetry readings are held. That included the former U.S. Poet Laureate Robert Pinsky, and Robert Pinsky entered through the same door, as did a poet named Stephen Zoltansky, who's 31 years old and emerging, when he was part of a reading there. During that time that I was at MoMA, I brought in over 200 poets to read, and they all entered through the back door. Now, when I first got to MoMA, one of the projects I considered doing was to padlock the front entrance for a day, forcing people to enter the museum through the back door. But then I kind of figured that's already happening on its own. So this, then, tonight is a lecture about how the back door is becoming the front, and by doing so is challenging institutions and the ways that they're structured. And it has a lot to do with changes brought on by the digital age, but it has its grounding in any number of modernist strategies, including deconstruction, institutional critique, radical poetics, and conceptual art. And tonight I'll be tracing this sort of subjective history, discussing the situations and changes I've witnessed from somehow being on the inside of major institutions. While it's primarily about my interactions with institutions as a poet, I think the lessons and stories can pretty much be applied across the board as being representative of broad cultural shifts that many fields are experiencing now. Now, let me just preface this by saying, as poets, we have nothing to lose. It's really an outlaw business. It's our obligation to cause trouble, to identify and rub salt and open wounds, to be unruly guests at parties, saying things we oughtn't. Why? Because we can. And because poetry has no monetary value, it's liberated from the orthodoxies that constrain just about every other form of art. As such, it's obliged to take chances. Poetry is obliged to be as experimental as it can be. It is bulletproof in its weakness, and its powerlessness. Like a perfume, or a fart, or a body odor slithering between cracks in the wall, poetry wafts under shut doorways and stealthily sneaks in the back door unnoticed. And because nobody really pays attention to it, it dons this invisibility cloak, free to go where it wants and when it wants. Poetry doesn't need you. It doesn't require your permission to exist. It doesn't care if you love it or not. It's marvelously illegitimate, and it's proudly fraudulent. The whole endeavor, quite frankly, is a farce. Poetry does not need institutional support. After all, it proceeds perfectly well without it. It requires no money, no funding, no backers, no consensus, no ass-kissing, no political compromises. All the money in the world can't make a better poem or a better books of poems. Great books of poems are being written and published all the time without money, any money whatsoever, and more money and more poetry than can ever be published is being written every day by people around the world. When the biggest publishing houses in the world publish poetry, they always lose money on it. And yet, this is why poetry is important. Poetry today occupies the position that conceptual art once held in the art world. Conceptual art was, in its inception, an act of resistance, one through dematerialization called into question the status of the unique art object and the sole privilege of the author. It proposed that art could be made by anyone, regardless of their skill set. And it also claimed that art could have democratic distribution systems able to be experienced by all. Of course, we know that today conceptual art has been thoroughly integrated into the canon of art history and has acquired great value. A place like this, of course, is full of it. And yet, its original utopian ethos lives on, continuing to provide much-needed frameworks, strategies of resistance, and roadmaps for our increasingly dematerialized and radically democratic digital world. Now, one strain of conceptual art is known as institutional critique, which takes as its subject matter the way institutions frame and control discourses surrounding the artworks they exhibit, rather than focusing on the content of the works themselves. A more traditional approach would be to isolate an artwork and to appreciate its aesthetic values while ignoring the context in which it's being displayed and the factors that brought it there. Institutional critique claims that the structures surrounding the works are actually what gives the work much of its meaning, oftentimes controlling the reception of a work in ways that we as viewers are unaware of. While institutional critique began in the museum, the practice evolved over time to include everything from the production and distribution of art to an examination of the corporate offices or collectors' homes where the art was hung. By the 1980s, it roped in art criticism, academic lectures, and art's reception in the popular press. And around the same time, art schools began offering classes in post-studio practice, where the studying of institutional critique became an act of making art in and of itself. And so you get works like this, which is Hans Hacke's 1970s MoMA poll, which literally was a poll that asked viewers, would the fact that Governor Rockefeller has not denounced President Nixon's Indochina policy be a reason for your not voting for him in November? And he provided these two plexiglass boxes into which yes or no ballots could be cast. Now, while aesthetically the piece fit into the primary structures and information-based art of the period, Hacke meant to shed light on the fact that Nelson Rockefeller was a member of MoMA's board, thereby making visible the normally hidden play of money, power, and politics behind the institution. Another tactic is to take objects from a museum's collection and rearrange them in ways that highlight the biases of that collection. So, for instance, in 1993, the African-American artist Fred Wilson critiqued the Maryland Historical Society's collection in relationship to Maryland's history of slavery. For this show, he regrouped specific objects from the museum in order to speak of a history which the museum and the community wouldn't talk about, the history of the exclusion and the abuse that African-American people experienced in that area. Other works have focused on the physical institution itself. This is Andrea Fraser acting as a fake docent, leading a group at the Philadelphia Museum on false tours, not of the works on the walls, but of security systems, water fountains, and in this picture, she's talking about the food in the cafeteria. In 2003, Fraser performed what was perhaps the ultimate work of institutional critique. A collector paid $20,000 to sleep with her, quote, not for sex, according to Fraser, but to make an artwork, unquote. And yet, surprisingly, institutional critique has its roots in poetry, or rather, a poet's disenchantment with his career trajectory. In 1964, Marcel Broders, an impoverished poet associated for many years with the radical left wing of the Belgian Surrealist movement, took 44 unsold copies of his last volume of poetry, embedded them in plaster, and represented them, as you can see here, as a sculpture in a gallery. With this one gesture, he symbolically annulled his career as a writer by rendering his already economically worthless books now completely unreadable, and at the same time, by recontextualizing them as art, gave license to magically transform them into commodifiable art objects. By prioritizing cultural context over artistic content, Broder's gesture is generally considered the first work of institutional critique. The first time he showed these plaster-embedded books, Broder's released a statement which made explicit his intentions. And he said, "I, too, wondered whether I could not sell something and succeed in life. For some time, I had been no good at anything. I'm 40 years old, and finally, the idea of inventing something insincere crossed my mind, and I set to work straight away." Now, there's something prescient about Broder's practice as to much work that's been staged in the poetry world recently. With the emergence of conceptual poetics, the possibilities for critical, self-reflexive devices have become somewhat commonplace. And so you have these two words that Broder's used, unreadability and insincerity, are words you actually hear batted around poetry a lot today. In fact, you could say that two recent movements, conceptual writing's unreadability and Flarf's insincerity, are founded upon and enact these exact practices. The idea of creating books that aren't somehow meant to be read, but instead act as triggers for discourses that lay far outside the page or reading experience, point to something that is increasingly happening with cultural artifacts situated in the digital world. We seem to be less interested in interacting with them as content. Rather, we treat them more like objects or containers that could be filled with anything or with nothing. And in doing so, we've all become en masse archivists and librarians. And we choose to share when we choose to share our digital artifacts on social networking or on blogs, we take the additional role of educators, eager to share what we know with everyone that we know. So by extension, I think it's fair to say that most of us spend as much time organizing our vast collections of media than we actually do interacting with them. Most of us have more music on our hard drives than we'll ever be able to listen to, and yet we keep getting more. I actually spend more time acquiring, cataloging, and archiving my digital artifacts these days than I do actually engaging with them, suggesting to me that the ways in which culture is distributed and archived have become profoundly more intriguing than the cultural artifact itself. You can say we've experienced an inversion of consumption, one in which we've come to engage in a more profound way with the acts of acquisition over that which we are acquiring. We've come to prefer the bottles to the wine. This, then, could be proposed as a form of institutional critique of artifacts and the way that they circulate in the digital world. If you take a blog like Boing Boing, for instance, they're one of the most powerful blogs on the web, and yet they don't create anything. Rather, they filter the morass of information that's out there, and they pull up the best stuff. The fact of Boing Boing linking to something far outweighs the thing that they're linking to. The new creativity, then, is in pointing, not making. Likewise, in the future, the best writers will be the best information managers. Now, these ideas have led to a reconfiguration of our sense of the physical world as well, as best expressed by the phenomenon over the past 2 or 3 years that's become known as the new aesthetic, which articulates the mapping of the digital world onto the physical one. Not content to live exclusively on the screen, memes, images, and ideas born of digital culture are infiltrating and expressing themselves in meat space. And so you just have to think of the pixelated camouflage that the military wears called Digicam as a handy example of stuff that's kind of born out there and ends up on our bodies. So the slight warping of reality, at once familiar and disconcerting, represents a paradigmatic shift in the way that we process aesthetics, leading the science fiction writer Bruce Sterling to say, quote, "Look at these objects objectively. Scarcely one of the real things in there would have made sense to anyone in 1982 or in 1992. People of those times would not have known what they were seeing with these new objects. aesthetic images. So you actually have this radically different aesthetic moment that's happening right now. This new aesthetic, then, embraces hybrid strategies, casting aspersions on artistic practices perpetuated within and contingent upon self-sustaining cloistered environments. New notions of distributions come into play as well. Those practices that are based on singularity, such as the art market, are beginning to which is beginning to resemble the antiques market, appear headed for obsolescence. Likewise, sealed-off invented worlds like Second Life and virtual reality are giving way to integrated terrestrial cyber hybrids such as geotagging and, of course, augmented reality, aligning the new aesthetic with long-standing media-based documentarian practices such as Andy Warhol, Candid Camera, An American Family, reality television, and Sacha Baron Cohen. This is a strain which proclaims that real life, reframed and recontextualized, conjure up is much more creative, inventive, and twisted and weird than what we could possibly conjure up in our fictive imaginations. And just think of the promotional Google Glass video that everyone's been seeing. The live stream is on 24/7, and really, we are just at the beginning of this. One of the ways of historically contextualizing this phenomena might be through Marcel Duchamp's concept of the infrathin, this state between states. Duchamp defines the infrathin as, quote, the warmth of a seat which has just been left, or velvet trousers, their whistling sound in walking by, the brushing of two legs is an infrathin separation signaled by sound. That's how Duchamp defines it, so beautiful. Like an electronic current, the infrathin hovers and pulses, creating a dynamic stasis, refusing to commit to one state or the other. The 21st century, then, is invisible. The surface of things is the wrong place to find the 21st century. Instead, the unseen, the infrathin, these tiny devices in our pockets, or the thick data haze which permeates the air we breathe, locates us in the present. And in this way, the new aesthetic is not so much of a movement as it is a marker, a movement of observation which informs us that culture, along with its means of production and its reception, has radically shifted beneath our feet while we were looking the other way. If we're witnessing a swapping of content for distribution, then the most relevant work of institutional critique in the poetry world, as filtered through the new aesthetic to date, is the now infamous a book called Issue One, which was published in 2008. It was a 3,785-page unauthorized and unpermissioned anthology, quote, written by 3,164 poets whose poems were actually not authored by the poets to whom they were attributed. Instead, the poems were generated by a computer which randomly synced each author with a poem. Stylistically, it made absolutely no sense. A well-known traditional poet was paired with a radically disjunctive verse poem penned by a computer, and vice versa. And yet it wasn't so much the stylistics that raised eyebrows, it was the mechanics of it, the distribution and the notification, which riled the contributors. The work was stitched into this massive PDF, which was placed on a media server late one evening, and many people found out about their inclusion the first thing in the morning when finding that the Google alert they had set for their name had notified them that they were included in a major new poetry anthology. And clicking on the link brought them to the anthology, whereupon downloading it, of course, they did a search and found their name attached to a poem that they did not write. Like wildfire, the reaction spread through the community. Was I in it? Why was I in it? Was I not in it? Why wasn't I in it. Was my name matched with that poem? Who was responsible for this act? While some contributors were delighted to be included, going so far as to publish their issue one poem in their own next volume of poetry, claiming it as their own, others, of course, were wildly angered. And there really wasn't much to discuss about the poems themselves in regard to everything else going on around this gesture. The poems themselves seemed pretty irrelevant. We were forced to consider the conceptual apparatuses that these anonymous authors had set into motion. With one gesture, like Marcel Broder's, they had swapped the focus from content to context. Okay, and in April of 2011, that was a year after I was here, the critic Robert Archambault wrote of my own work. He said, "There are points, especially lately, where Goldsmith seems to be going in a direction, like a lot of what he does, that has been taken before in the art world, but has been less common in the poetry world. It's a turn to the idea of the career itself as the most important medium of the art. There are plenty of ways to do this, but the way Goldsmith seems to be going about it is one that people who are critical of the apparatus of fame, the market and cultural capital and symbolic goods, and the construction of status might find disconcerting. Goldsmith distances himself from the idea of text as art object and moves toward the effect, the simulation and stimulation of thought, and the generation of conversation about the object as the real medium of his art. It's not quite the artist's career as artist medium, but I see it as a step in that direction." And he goes on to say, "It's a direction I personally see as a bit what? I suppose destined to produce unhappiness for those who take it," is the phrase. And that's the end of this guy's quote. Now, I'm curious how a perfect stranger might be able to predict my future mental state, which, of course, has been very happy. Archambault's skepticism is typical of the unexamined reaction that the poetry world often falls back upon when they suspect that poets are engaging with institutions on any level. But with little interest in avant-garde writing in the general population, if not for institutions, my own poetic practice and my work would be nearly invisible. Here we are in an institution. So you have this idea of the institution as survival strategy. In fact, for advanced poetries, meaning the ones that are decidedly non or anti-populist, if this work in America is not received in the academy, it's not received at all. If my work isn't being taught or written about, it doesn't exist. With this historical knowledge over the years, as various mainstream institutions reach out to support it, from Ivy League universities to well-funded literary and academic journals, major museums like the one we're in right now, and even the White House, I always said yes, but with a caveat that I couldn't be censored and had to be allowed to say what I needed to say in the way I needed to say it, however distasteful that might be to the institution. And believe me, I've made some very provocative claims over the years. So an engagement with an institution can be like holding up a mirror to that institution, a limit test to see what it is capable or incapable of. Now, these old attitudes die hard. The poetry world was largely critical of my acceptance of an invitation to read at the White House of May 2011, as Terry said, most prominently articulated by the poet and blogger Lynn Dinh, who claimed, quote, "To be a minstrel for a mass murderer is nothing to be proud of. This just heightens my contempt for the state of American poetry. Did Bertolt Brecht dance for Hitler? Future generations will look back at us and retch very sad," end quote. Of quote from Lynn Dinh. And yet the institution, in the form of Al Filreis of the University of Pennsylvania, he's my boss, and of course they're my employer, left to my defense with a nuanced and moderate argument. He responded to Dinh by saying, "I don't disagree with you about war, that's certain, but I obviously do disagree about what Kenny has specifically said yes to. Michelle Obama has done a few good things in the arts, but this reading series that she had mostly put together hasn't so far been one of them. Her people asked the usual suspects, Billy Collins and people like that, and someone in her office had the fairly unusual idea of trying something different and aesthetically, and so Kenny, who must have pondered the downsides of accepting, decided on balance that helping to provide some poetic range was a good thing to do. Goldsmith is no Brecht in mode or intention, and so I don't expect him to refuse in a manner that presumably Brecht would have, even in your imagined anthology. And while Obama has been to me and many others, I admire a disappointment, and in war policies worse than that, I don't consider him a Hitler, though I've thought about totalitarianism a good deal. Okay. In regards to my considering the downsides of the invitation to the White House, I realize this would provide a rare opportunity to put radical poetic theory and practice into institutional play. In fact, what it would reveal about the surprising structure of that particular institution would prove to be more valuable than the blunt warnings against participating at all. But I did stop to consider the invitation. When I was asked to read, I wondered aloud to Al, who you just heard from, who is, again, my boss. I said to Al, I said, if I was asked by the G.W. Bush administration to read, would I have accepted? To which he responded, Kenny, you never would have been asked to read at the G.W. Bush White House. Enough said. So, let's look at what actually happened at the White House to see how it played out on institutional terms. This is actually the menu at the canteen there. And right to the right of this sign is the Situation Room. You know, I mean, it's completely freaky. So the day was split up into two parts. In the afternoon, there was a poetry workshop led by Michelle Obama in the State Dining Room, and then in the evening, there was this formal reading in the East Room. And while there were eight poets, quote, poets invited to read, most of them were entertainers who performed their lyrics as poetry, such as Jill Scott, Common, Amy Mann, and Steve Martin, who brilliantly, really brilliantly set a W.H. Auden poem to bluegrass music. He was amazing. The only other self-identified poets beside myself were Rita Dove. By the way, this is Jon Stewart making fun of my outfit at the White House that night after the reading. So we're Rita Dove. And of course, the former poet laureate Billy Collins. And I should also mention that one great avant-garde visual artist, Allison Knowles, was also present. It was a great honor to be really with all of those people to share the stage with Allison. Pardon me. In terms of the institution, when I was invited to... pardon me. In terms of the institution, when I was invited to read, I was really only given one rule, that I could not read anything political at the White House. What that meant, I was never told. Other than that, I had free rein to read whatever I wanted. And once I had decided upon my reading, I had to submit it for approval. Now, upon arriving in the White House in the morning, this is me and Billy Collins and Rita Dove. The poets, we did a sound check, and we ran through our sets while these weird handlers sort of scurried about setting up the room for the evening's event. And during that time, Joe Reinstein, our host, who was the deputy social secretary to the president, was present from the administration. During my sound check, or afterwards, Joe made a helpful suggestion regarding the pacing of my introduction. It was good advice, made my set flow better. But from that time until the moment I went on stage, nobody commented upon what I was to read. In fact, that evening, face to face with the president, it dawned on me, really, that as I got up there on stage, there was going to be nothing stopping me from reading something other than what I told them I was going to do. I could have read something political or made some sort of unexpected intervention, but much to my detractors' chagrin, I didn't. I stuck to the script, which for my purposes turned out to be the best thing to do. In the afternoon session with the First Lady, when I was interviewed about my practice by Elizabeth Alexander, who had read the inaugural poem for the first inauguration, in front of the White House press corps, a room full of high school students and dozens of bureaucrats, again, I wasn't vetted about what I could say or what I couldn't say. I simply said what I said again and again, making my arguments against creativity for copyleft, for breaking copyright law, for file sharing, and for free culture. This in the White House. I was advocating breaking laws. It was absolutely bizarre. As the critic Marjorie Perloff described it, Marjorie said, "Against the usual admonition to look in thy heart and write, Rita Dove has just told the group that, quote, only you can tell your story. So if you remain true to your own experience, your voice will find you." Goldsmith begins by noting how his own students are penalized for any shred of originality or creativity they might show. He says, instead they are rewarded for plagiarism, identity theft, repurposing papers, patch writing, sampling, plundering, and stealing. Not surprisingly, they thrive. Suddenly what they've surreptitiously become expert at is brought out into the open and explored in a safe environment, reframed in terms of responsibility instead of recklessness. Copying, cutting and pasting, downloading, recycling, these activities, Goldsmith argues, will actually teach students more about literature than the seeming originality of self-expression. Nobody blinked an eye. When discussing my entirely appropriated book, Day, which is a transcription of the Day's copy of the New York Times, I was interrupted by an engrossed First Lady who insisted on knowing what day I chose to transcribe. The lack of resistance to what I was saying was remarkable. I walked into the green room in the White House, and there was a stack of all my books. In fact, and all of these are appropriated, they all break copyright. Everything in these books have been stolen. I haven't written an original word of them. In fact, the White House was the most frictionless place I've ever been. Nothing ever goes wrong there. Like walking on air or being on the moon, there's this complete lack of gravity. Due to the most insane security, it feels like the freest, most relaxed place on Earth. It's like everybody's on a combination of Prozac and ecstasy. And here we are hanging out on the portico with Amy Mann and her hipster band, you know, just relaxing. There's some dude from the White House, but everybody else was, you know, it was like being in a rock club or something. And everything I said there seemed to be met with big smiles and nods of approval.